From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Coronavirus cases are skyrocketing across the United States, and global data shows that poorer nations and the U.S. are driving infections up internationally. Misinformation about the virus abounds on the internet, in large part stemming from a mistrust of government that President Donald Trump and his supporters thrive on. Now, a science journalist who has written about pandemics even before this year says that as a whole, we need a paradigm shift on how we think about contagious diseases if we are to survive. Sonia Shah is a science journalist and the author of Pandemic, Tracking Contagion from Cholera to Ebola and Beyond, a book written in 2016. Her latest book is The Next Great Migration, The Beauty and Terror of Life on the Move. She just wrote an article in The Nation called It's Time to Tell a New Story About Coronavirus. Our lives depend on it. Welcome to the program, Sonia.
Nice to be here.
So before we get to what this paradigm shift is that you referred to, did the path of this disease as it has gone since March to July now, has it in any way surprised you? Or knowing what Trump has done or not done, are you basically seeing the predictable results of what he of his policies?
I think it is pretty predictable. I mean, even, you know, the reason I was able to write a whole book about how pandemics unfold is because this was predicted. We knew that hundreds of new pathogens had been reemerging and emerging into new places. This latest coronavirus is just the newest one. We had Zika, we had Ebola, we have new kinds of tick-borne diseases, new kinds of antibiotic-resistant pathogens. So the fact that we are facing a pandemic-causing pathogen right now is not at all surprising. It was predicted to happen. What has been surprising is how chaotic the Trump administration response has been, but the results of that chaotic response are absolutely predictable, and we're seeing the results right now. We're living through it all, of course.
When you wrote the book, your book a few years ago, you already saw that there was a foundation for this sort of disease to emerge, which I suppose was also something that the Obama administration knew about, hence they had a handbook in place for the Trump administration. This was something that should have been predictable, but how is coronavirus different from previous diseases? It seems to really have confounded our scientific community because it seems to be affecting our the human body in ways that we just can't understand yet.
Yeah, so when I was writing my book, I spent 4 years putting it together, and I would ask all the experts I talked to, you know, what do you think, which is the pathogen that keeps you up at night? What is going to be the next big one? And they almost all had one of two answers. One was a highly drug-resistant form of bacterial pathogen, like a so-called superbug. And the other was a respiratory pathogen that spreads like influenza, but is just a little bit more deadly. And that's exactly what coronavirus, the novel coronavirus, is. It's confounding because it's so transmissible, but, you know, in terms of like the universe of viruses that are out there that we thought might be the next thing that would cause a pandemic, like as horrible as this pandemic has been and will be moving forward, this pathogen, it actually could be so much worse. Like what I was predicting is that we would have a pathogen that would affect young people, for example, more heavily than older people. And that's not what we're seeing right now. So in some ways, you know, there's a lot worse that pathogens can actually do and have done in the past. We've had much more deadly pathogens causing pandemics and pathogens that have caused more death in younger age groups, which is, you know, of course, it's horrible when anyone dies, but like societies are very much more traumatized when it's young people as opposed to, you know, people who are it's 65, 80 and above.
So let's look at history. You write in your article in The Nation that when, 200 years ago, when we had cholera first emerge, that scientists had to change the way they even just thought about disease and how disease spreads.
Absolutely. So when like we think of cholera as sort of a poor person's disease today, and that is true now, but when cholera first emerged in the 1800s, it was never before seen, and it affected the most sort of cutting edge cities and towns of its time. London, Paris, Hamburg, New York, New Orleans, all of those cities were struck by epidemics of cholera that killed thousands of people, and this kept going on for about the better part of a century. One of the problems was that doctors were really confounded by how cholera spread. We know today that cholera spreads through contaminated water, but at the time there was a very long-lasting tradition that dated back to Hippocrates that contagious diseases spread through what were called miasmas. These were sort of smelly airs, basically clouds of gas that people inhale, and that's how you would get an infectious disease. So, you know, that made a certain amount of sense for the old diseases like malaria, which is not carried by air, but it is carried by mosquitoes that are more frequently found, you know, where there's smelly airs around wetlands, swamps, et cetera. So if you avoided those places, you might actually avoid some of the old diseases like malaria. But for a new disease like cholera, the theory of miasmas actually made things much worse. Doctors thought that this is something you inhaled. So they wanted to get rid of all the smelly gases around them. They thought that would be a good public health intervention. So some people would do things like string up, you know, pieces of meat to absorb the cholera vapor, as they called it. Other people would install flush toilets, not because they wanted to get rid of the contents of their, you know, of the human waste, but just to get rid of the smell. And so since they didn't care about where all the contents went, they would dump that right in the drinking water. And in fact, in the city of London, during the cholera epidemics of the 19th century, people installed more flush toilets after every cholera outbreak rather than less. So they made cholera a lot worse by dumping more and more human waste into their drinking water. So the paradigm of how they understood infectious diseases really did not match up with how this new disease spread. But, you know, just like we do today, we apply the paradigm that has served us well in the past to the new disease, even if it doesn't fit that well.
So when we heard in the early months of this disease, we heard officials like Trump say, well, this is just like the flu. That was wrong on many levels, right?
I mean, in a way, it is similar to the flu, but that is not to minimize it. Flu is a huge problem. I mean, you think about influenza pandemics every year that we, you know, we have population immunity to a large extent because we get them every year. We spend billions of dollars developing flu vaccines every year, and even so, 500,000 people die around the world from flu every year. So to say it's like the flu is, I think he meant to minimize it, but in fact, influenza is a very serious public health problem. And if you added even one more influenza on top of the one we have, it would be like, it would be hugely problematic. And that's, you know, basically we're doing that plus a lot worse right now with coronavirus. I think the broader issue is that we think of contagious diseases today, our paradigm is sort of this idea of invasion, that these are alien microbes that are foreign and external to us, and they kind of invade us, and we become then sort of passive populations that just have to kind of, you know, are sort of unsuspecting and passive. And therefore, what we have to do to protect ourselves is close the borders, don't let anybody in. Once they come in, we have to have our armaments, our drugs, our vaccines to kind of, you know, killing chemicals to kind of surgically contain and destroy these external agents. But I think what we're seeing is more the case is that it may not be that the latest drug and vaccine is not going to come in time to save us from the huge toll of this particular virus. What's going to save us is something quite different from that. It's social cooperation, it's solidarity, it's, you know, collective action. And we're seeing that around the edges in other societies that have been able to do that, for example, by all wearing masks or all staying indoors or, you know, whatever it is that they trust their public health authorities and they take these cooperative actions and it actually works. Meanwhile, here in the US, we're so focused on let's throw more and more money to drug companies to give us this wonder shot. And we're putting all of our eggs in that basket. We're not thinking about, well, how do we build trust between ourselves? How do we build trust in our institutions and in collective action so that we actually can change our behavior? And that's what's going to actually save us from at least the first wave of the disease, which is more usually the most deadly part, because that's when, you know, people have no experience of it at all.
I want to quote from your article in The Nation, where you say this paradigm of the invasive germ became a dominant force in Western medicine, as one observer put it. Part of this may have been the genuine elegance of the theory, but the magic bullet cures it made possible also dovetailed with the logic of industrial capitalism, which I think is such an important aspect of the story, because our approach to healthcare as a whole in the United States has been focused on the individual, right? The fact that an individual may have access to, you know, innovative treatments, or cutting edge treatments, but that is somehow more important than than all Americans having universal access to free healthcare. And the pandemic, I suppose, is the worst way. The coronavirus pandemic is the worst way to find out that that approach is disastrous.
Yeah, I mean, it's really about, do we look at our social conditions and try to improve the way we interact with each other, with our other species, other parts of our ecosystem, and try to manage that in ways that reduce the impact of a virus like this? You know, to me, that really could be central. That should be the central activity that we're doing right now in terms of containment. Instead, we're doing that on the margins. And what we're really, as a society, we're spending our time and resources doing is creating, you know, profit-driven commodities to save us from this. And like you said, in an individualistic fashion. I mean, it's very, you know, in keeping with our capitalist system and our capitalist habit of mind, that the most important thing is that we have a product that can, you know, each of us can buy off the shelf or go ask our doctor to give us, as opposed to maybe the most important thing is that we have strong institutions and strong societies and strong interactions with each other where we trust each other to do things that reduce transmission, whether it's providing good housing for people, providing sick leave so people can stay home when they're sick, providing benefits so people can stay home and not go to work at all, if that's what we need to do. You know, in the what we need to do is going to change from place to place as the virus ebbs and flows. But to do any of it, we need to be able to make collective action. And we need to really think about our social behavior as the main issue, as opposed to when do we get the thing? When do we get the magic pill, the magic potion?
And the U.S.'s approach to the virus is very much in line with this magic pill approach, because it has poured so much more money into developing a vaccine at, quote, warp speed than into testing, which is one of the most effective ways in which nations can ensure that as few people as possible catch the virus. I want to go back to the science of it, and you write about this in your article as well, about how Western medicine has approached this notion of the invasive pathogen has not successfully distinguished between, you know, good bacteria and bad bacteria, for example. And so in turning bacteria or viruses into this idea of invading the pure human body has shown already to be not a very good theory of how the human body works, right? I mean, we have an over-reliance on antibiotics, etc.
Yeah, and I think it, you know, and it translates into how we prioritize, you know, what kind of knowledge is important right now. You know, the questions we're sidelining, which should be more central, is like, you know, we act as if you have the pathogen, it's bad, it's you're automatically contaminated. But it's always been more complex than that, right? Like, we already know, even with coronavirus, that dose matters, that if you get a little bit of it, maybe you won't get sick, or maybe the same amount that makes me sick is not going to make someone else sick. It's very variable, because it's all about an interaction, right? It's not just about, is the pathogen present or absent? So I mean, I think that more nuanced view is out there, but it needs to be much more central so that we make that central in our policy. It's not about just extinguishing every trace of virus out there, right? I mean, if you have a little bit of exposure, for some people, that could actually be protective. I mean, that's actually the whole concept of vaccination, is you give people a little bit of the pathogen and that triggers the immune response that then protects them for when they get, when they encounter it again. But we think of the germ as this evil thing that we can't have even a little trace of it. And I think that is very much in keeping with the whole idea of killing chemicals. And, the drug industry has been very successful and in saying that, look, we can stamp this thing out with just a pill. You don't have to think about these other more complex issues. We can really reduce this to a very simple problem of you have something in your body, you don't want it there. We're going to give you a chemical to get rid of it.
Let's talk about the politics of masks and mask wearing. There was a new study showing that those who wear masks aren't just protecting others from themselves, that masks now we're finding increasingly offer protection to the wearer as well, and that one can be wearing a mask in a room where someone is infected, and because you would get a probably lower dose of virus via the mask, as opposed to without it, you might have or be more likely to have asymptomatic infection. Adopting widespread mask wearing requires Americans as a whole to think very differently about public health than they do now, right? We've had this, Whole Foods CEO approach to your personal health is in your hands, nutrition and exercise, never mind single payer healthcare, focus on your own health. Therefore, we're seeing mask refusers say things like, you want to wear a mask, you wear a mask, but I don't have to wear a mask. It doesn't work unless everyone's wearing it though, right? Or most people are wearing it.
Yeah, right. Most people wearing it and then well dispersed in the community so that we can kind of cover for the people who aren't wearing them, the same way vaccination works.
Right. In fact, widespread vaccination is a much better analogy. And given the vaccine skepticism we've seen in this country growing over the years, it doesn't bode well for coronavirus, whether where masks are concerned or a future vaccine. I mean, we could have a future vaccine and Trump could declare victory, but will Americans take it?
That's one question. Will Americans take it? And I think there's a real conflict of interest for him because he has actively encouraged the vaccine skeptic audience, right? So he said, I think early on in his campaign, he repeated the falsehood that the measles vaccine has something to do with autism. And he's elevated some of those really prominent vaccine skeptic voices. He thinks he's going to be able to sell the whole nation on some vaccine that's developed at warp speed. I mean, it really doesn't inspire confidence at all. So I think that's going to be a real issue with any vaccine we get. And I think the other part of it is that, I think a lot of us are thinking of the vaccine as something that's going to be 90, 95%, 99% effective. And I think more likely it's going to be much less than that. The usual influenza vaccine is only 30, 40% effective. It's still worth doing. But again, it's that same thing. It's like, you're doing it for others. You're doing it out of a social responsibility to protect not just yourself, but your family members and your neighbors and your colleagues and all the rest of it. So having a vaccine developed so quickly in a country where there's so much skepticism about public health interventions already, it's hard to see how that's going to get us where we actually need to be with this pandemic. I mean, I think it'll be PR points for the president if he can get something out there in time. But what we really need to look at is like how effective is it going to be, and what percentage of the population will have to take this vaccine in what time period in order to protect all of us. And if it's the less effective it is, the more coverage you need. And to date, we haven't had any vaccine against any coronavirus ever. Coronaviruses are a big family of viruses. A lot of them cause disease other than COVID-19, which would be worthwhile to protect against with a vaccine, and we don't have anything. Mm-hmm. So, having a highly effective vaccine that's really safe and effective is actually the exception to the rule, which is not to say vaccines are not going to be useful, but they're just going to be one part of the whole picture. The social behaviors that we need to change are going to be as important, if not more important, especially in this like critical period that we're in right now with this first wave of infections.
One of the other things that you mention in your article in The Nation, which I think is such a critical piece of this, is how capitalist American society as a whole is organized around industrial agriculture and also our systems of detention. We have a society built on crowded spaces where humans are forced to crowd and crowded spaces where animals are forced to crowd, none of which is conducive to a safe environment, and all of which exacerbate, you know, existing threats like the coronavirus pandemic. And I just wonder, you know, will we see those pieces of the puzzle as central to the question of how to solve this terrible moment we're in?
Yeah, I think housing has been critical. Housing reform has been critical in taming a lot of pathogens in the past. So we have been here before. Mm-hmm. You know, when we had cholera pandemics in the 19th century, a big part of solving those cholera pandemics was better housing, better plumbing, indoor sanitation, these things, so people weren't always exposed to each other's waste. Right. So we created new housing reforms that allowed us to conquer that disease. It took a long time. For malaria, what helped us get rid of malaria? Malaria was one of the most prominent American diseases in the entire continent for centuries after the Europeans got here. We got rid of it primarily by changing the way we live. We started putting window screens on our windows so mosquitoes couldn't fly in and bite us at night. We started using electricity so people could be indoors in the evenings rather than out on the porches where, you know, they were near vulnerable to mosquito bites. We started doing good drainage so we didn't have standing water around us all the time, stagnant water where mosquitoes breed. You know, all of these things were very hard-won social reforms where we change the way we live in order to block the transmission of these diseases. Those pathogens still exist in the world. We didn't have to get rid of every malaria parasite and every cholera bacteria. In fact, there's cholera bacteria floating in the waters of many of our, you know, bodies of water today in the Chesapeake Bay, right, you know, right near where I live in Maryland. There's cholera bacteria in there. But we don't have cholera anymore because we changed the way we live. And so, you know, there's a history to this, and we're going to come face to face with it right now, where we're seeing, like you said, people in meatpacking plants, people in detention centers. You know, there's going to be super spreading events because of the way people live. And that's something we're going to have to address. And it's going to be a lot harder than just coming up with some pill or potion.
And the big question is, will Americans realize the changes that need to be made and adopt them in time? You know, time is of the essence. This virus is spreading so fast, and it's really shocking to see, unfortunately, or maybe it's not that shocking, that the United States, with all its attendant issues, is leading the virus count worldwide. Are there some... well, let me ask you this. We're expecting not just the vaccine as a magic bullet. We're expecting to, quote, return to normal by a year or two from now. And everything that you're telling me suggests that we really need to be looking at recreating a new normal.
I think that's true. I mean, I think for this pathogen is going to collapse eventually. We're not going to be living in this way, in this crisis mode that we're in right now forever. You know, all epidemics, they go up like this and they collapse on their own eventually when enough people are immune or have already had it and have, you know, are not in the population anymore. So you know, but I think in the bigger picture, you know, we've had hundreds of new pathogens emerge since 1940. And it's happening because of the way we are interacting with the reservoirs of these microbes, which is wild animals. We know 60% of the new pathogens we're seeing today come from animals' bodies, 70% come from the bodies of wild animals. And that's because we are pushing animals into our habitats because we're destroying theirs. You know, we've invaded so much wildlife habitat that we're losing 150 species a day, but the species that remain, they have to crowd even closer and closer to where we live. And that just provides a lot of opportunities for us to interact with animals in novel ways that allow their microbes to come into our bodies, whether it's through wildlife trade or, you know, hunting, bushmeat hunting, or agriculture, or just recreationally, you know, just casual contact. We're going to get through this eventually. It is going to be messy. It's going to be deadly. And it's going to have a long hangover after the fact. But we're not going to be done then, because the underlying drivers that bring these microbes into human populations are still there. And that's what we need to address.
Sonia, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. We'll post a link to your article in The Nation magazine from our website. Really appreciate your insight.
Thank you. Nice talking to you.
My guest has been Sonia Shah. She's a science journalist and the author of Pandemic: Tracking Contagion from Cholera to Ebola and Beyond, published in 2016. Her latest book is The Next Great Migration: The Beauty and Terror of Life on the Move. We've been discussing her new article in The Nation called It's Time to Tell a New Story About Coronavirus. Our Lives Depend on It. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.